The Campus Dialogue on Race is taking place this week here at Humboldt State University. And today in the studio with me, I have author Benjamin Madley. And Benjamin is a historian of Native America and the United States and colonialism in world history. And he is teaching down at UCLA, right?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Tell the listeners about your work at UCLA.
So I'm a professor of history, but I'm also the chair of the American Indian Studies Interdepartmental Program.
Benjamin, tell us a bit about yourself, because you grew up fairly locally here.
I did. I grew up just over the mountains from here in Siskiyou County on our family's ranch near the little town of Happy Camp. And so as a young boy, I got to see the conflicts and the contests over natural resources and sovereignty between local Kuruk people and newcomers. My father was working with the Kuruk tribe, so that was an early entree to understanding the ways in which the past history of California often echoes into the present, profoundly shaping the world in which we live.
And as a youngster, how did you feel about what you were witnessing? Do you remember?
I didn't really understand the tragedy of California Indian history at that point in time, but we moved to Los Angeles when I entered high school, and that was when I began to wonder, where are all the Indian people? So it was only later in graduate school that I turned to carefully examining our state's relationship to California Indian people. And it was really while doing research as a graduate student at Oxford University in Britain that I first came across written evidence that corroborated the material that I had heard from Kuruk elders as a young boy.
And tell the listeners the title of your book.
So the title of this book is An American Genocide, The United States and the California Indian Catastrophe, 1846 to 1873. And what this book explores is the question of how exactly did California's Indian population plummet from perhaps 150,000 people in 1846 to perhaps 30,000 in 1873. And the research that I did reveals that while diseases, dislocation, starvation, and exposure did play a role in this catastrophe, there were other things also at work, things like forced removals, homicides, over 370 separate massacres, and slavery, all of which also contributed to this population catastrophe. And I don't think that it is at all an exaggeration to say that what happened here in California was a case of genocide.
So, doing all this research, what were some things that, I mean, I read an excerpt and from your book about a young girl and holding her sister, and it was just horrific what happened to all the Native American people and this one young lady.
It's absolutely a horrific story, and it's one for American Indian people in which the wounds are not yet healed. This is really not that long ago in our history, and the fingerprints of the state are all over this crime. As early as January 1851, the very first elected governor of the state of California publicly declared both the Senate and the Assembly of our state, and I quote, that a war of extermination will continue to be waged until the Indian race becomes extinct. And the very next month, California's legislature put the power of the purse behind that killing process by raising $500,000, a vast amount of money at that time, to fund past and future state militia campaigns against Indian people. And ultimately, there were 24 of these campaigns. That's 24 campaigns against California Indian people. And the state of California raised well over $1 million to fund them. They killed, at a very minimum, over 1,400 California Indian people. And then our Congress, the federal government, reimbursed the state of California for almost $1 million of those expenses. Now, the importance of the killing machine created by the state, these vigilante operations, or these militia operations, was not just the killings that they did, but how they inspired others, because they served as an implicit grant of legal impunity to other would-be killers, while also suggesting that vigilante groups could become militiamen and be highly remunerated for their killing. So vigilantes in the state of California during this period, they killed far more people, at a minimum 6,400 California Indians. But at the same time, the army was also involved. The army also killed at least 1,600 California Indian people during this period. So both the state and the federal government were heavily involved in the process.
It's just so horrific. And we know about some horrible things that have happened here locally to our tribes people as well. It's just awful. So doing this research, how did you get, like that one particular story, how did you gather the information to write the book?
So I visited a great number of archives and libraries in order to piece this all together. Now, the material wasn't hidden, or if it was hidden, it was hidden in plain sight, but it was scattered amongst many different archives. So my research took me as far away as Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. I also worked in Southern California at the Young Library in Los Angeles, and I also came up here to Humboldt State University's libraries, and I spent a lot of time reading your microfilm and some of the rare unpublished documents that are here at the HSU Redwood Room. So in sum, I think I visited over 24 different libraries, but I also spent a lot of time visiting California Indian communities, not only California Indian communities in California, but also diasporic California Indian communities, both in Oregon and in Oklahoma. And that was a big part of my research, was to talk to elders and council members and to learn from them about the kinds of things that I might find in the archives. So this is not a project where I write down the interviews that I conducted with Indian people, but it is a project in which I took a lot of inspiration from and clues that were provided to me by California Indians in order to find evidence of mass killings, evidence of village burnings, evidence of mass incarceration on reservations, evidence of rapes, evidence of child stealing. All of that was corroborated in indigenous oral histories, and then I found the materials about it in the archival material.
Okay, so you went, yeah, so you spoke with tribal members and found out about their parents or grandparents.
For example, right here in this area, right. I met with elders from Blue Lake Rancheria. Mm-hmm. I made multiple visits to Smith River, also Elk Valley, talked to people that I knew in Kodiak country on the Klamath River, and all of that helped to create a much richer, more nuanced picture of what actually happened.
And did you use their stories in your book as well and attribute it to them?
I used the ones that were published. Uh-huh. So I quoted published work, for example, by Lauren Bomlin from Smith River, from Sally Bell, from a wide variety of others.
Very good. Now, what's the reception been about your book from people like myself and also tribes people?
Well, the reception has been very, very positive, and it's been much more a national reception mm-hmm. than I had ever expected. So the very first review of the book came out in the New York Times, and the New York Times Book Review editor chose it as a selected title. There have been there was an extensive review in Newsweek. There was also an extensive review in The Nation, one in News from Native California. So it's really received a lot of press thus far. And last month, it won a prize from Heyday Books. It won the Heyday History Award.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Now, after writing this book, what have you walked away with as a person and a writer, getting all these stories? How do you feel about who we are as people?
Well, the question of what caused the Native American population cataclysm in this country mm-hmm. is central to understanding who we are now right. as a people and how we got here. Because the millions of square miles of land that yield the cornucopia of natural resources that make the United States so rich, the oil, gold, silver, the uranium, the timber, the fish, and all of that land that makes us the largest agricultural producer in the world is Indian land. We're sitting in Indian country right now in this studio. We're on Wiat land. And anywhere we go in the Humboldt Bay Area, and anywhere we go in the state of California, in fact, anywhere we go in the hemisphere, from the Arctic Ocean in the north to Patagonia in the south, more often than not, you're on the homeland of an indigenous nation. So how we understand the population catastrophe of indigenous people here in the United States is fundamental to informing how we see ourselves as a nation and individually as United States citizens. But while this is obviously painful to contemplate, the dead cannot be brought back to life, I think that rather than distance ourselves from this painful topic, we need to actually move closer to it in order to understand one of the fundamental events in the making of modern Native America, modern United States, and all of the modern Western Hemisphere.
I agree. I mean, it helps us to understand what we've done and where we're heading, right?
The past continues to shape the present, not only because of treaties that are so important to indigenous sovereignty in the United States, but for all Americans. These are central, beginning, fundamental origin events, not only for Humboldt County and for California, but for the United States as a whole.
Yep, and we still keep having problems, as we know.
Yes.
With the governments and Native tribes.
It's hard to imagine a private company being allowed to bulldoze the remains of Caucasian people interred in an ancient cemetery. It's hard to imagine a private security company getting away with unleashing attack dogs on women and children and elders, peaceful protectors of what is their land. It's hard to imagine that. So we have a long way to go as a nation and as a people to not only rectify the past and make amends for it, but to secure an honest and equitable present and an equitable future for indigenous people.
And the big question is, how do we get people to do that? You know, how? Based on the history, based on our future and what's going on and attitudes and all of it.
Well, one silver lining to this horrific story of genocide in California is the fact that we can now vote. In the 1850s, you had not been allowed to vote because you're female. In the 1850s, no people of color were voting or allowed to vote. But we have the possibility now, in a much more democratic society than 19th century California, to shape the way that we recollect and discuss these things. So it is up to us, it is up to voters to address, you know, how are we going to teach the genocide of California Indians to our youth in the schools? How might we memorialize these events with plaques or state-mandated days of public remembrance? How might these things enter our public discourse? All of these things are ultimately up to us.
Now it's just a matter of carrying through with doing that.
Right. And fortunately, California Indian people are taking a lead on these matters.
Mm-hmm.
If we think about memorialization, some of those memorialization activities are already taking place right here on Humboldt Bay. For example, on Indian Island, the annual candlelit vigil, or up at Yontocket in Del Norte County, the annual candlelit vigil up there, or the annual walk of the 1863 Concow Maidu Trail of Tears from Chico to Round Valley by Concow Maidu people and their advocates. So Indian people are aware of this and they're working on these issues, but it's important for them to have allies, to have people who are helping them in this very important work of bringing this painful past into the public consciousness so that we can heal and so that we can speak honestly about these founding events in our state's history.
It's really just powerful. Your book sounds, I have not read your book for those listeners, but it's, I've only read excerpts that are posted online. It's such a powerful book and history right there. Give people a link, if you could, to how to access your book.
Well, the book's available in some of the local bookstores mm-hmm. here in Arcata. Mm-hmm. I've seen it there. Mm-hmm. You can also find the book online at Barnes & Noble and at Amazon.com. And for those of us who don't have necessarily time to read a book, it's also available as an audiobook. So you can download it to your phone, or you can get a CD and play it in your car while you're on your drive to and from work or wherever you're going.
Oh, that sounds perfect. I had somebody reading to me just earlier from your book, which really was really wonderful. And I can't wait to see it and read it myself. So tell the listeners, you just did a talk today with students and faculty and probably some community members, right?
That's right.
Up at the Native American Forum, I believe. How was that? How was the response there from everybody?
That was a powerful experience. Mm-hmm. A substantial number of folks came down from Elk Valley and from Smith River Rancheria, Talua people. It was beautiful to hear the Talua language spoken in the opening prayers and to hear comments made by, for example, your own Talua scholars here at the university. People like Native American Studies professor Joe Giovanetti weighed in on this topic. And this is an engagement that I think is very important for the university to constantly be reaching out to Native communities, to be acknowledging that Humboldt State University sits on Native ground, Wiat ground, and to be developing the kind of robust, deep relationships with Native communities that can help not only students at HSLU to learn from community members in Indigenous communities, but the other way around as well.
That would be really good. And I know they're working on that here at HSU to integrate more. We're almost out of time. You're talking again tomorrow for those who missed you today. You're talking, no, do I have that right? Yes, tomorrow at 11. 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And this is at the HSU Library on the second floor. And it's called the Authors Hall. And apparently at least 400 people can fit in there. So
we should have plenty of room.
Yes. I heard that it was overflowing this afternoon for you. Will there be a question and answer period?
Yes, there will. I'll be happy to discuss the book and questions that people have about it. And I'll also be signing books after both today's talk and tomorrow's talk.
Okay. Well, this is just wonderful to have you here. Any last thoughts for our listeners?
I think some people have asked me why I spent 10 years of mm-hmm. my life working on such an incredibly difficult, dire plunge into the absolute depths of human depravity and human evil. And there are three reasons that I did this project. The first is common decency. I believe that long after Native people were killed, it's decent to explain what happened to them and to dignify their memory so that people can have some sense of closure about this tragedy. The second factor is justice. Even long after the perpetrators have disappeared, long after they've been buried in the ground, it makes sense to me to pursue some measure of justice by revealing the crimes that they and their advocates have all too often successfully concealed or denied or suppressed. And finally, there's the issue of veracity. It's the truth. It's the truth of what really happened, and everyone deserves to know.
I want to come hear you talk tomorrow, Benjamin. Benjamin Madley, thank you so much for coming here and talking with me and our listeners. I hope we've inspired some people to come out tomorrow. Again, this is on Thursday, tomorrow, November 3rd, from 11 a.m. until 1 p.m., and it's in the HSU Library, second floor, the Authors Hall. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.